For headlines, an information war in full swing over Ukraine. Moscow is opening a criminal case against U.S. tech giant Meta platforms for allowing death calls against Russian soldiers. UNICEF says the Saudi war could disrupt education for up to 6 million Yemeni children. Also ahead, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's so-called citizenship law is proof of the regime's racist nature. The online video sharing platform YouTube says it is blocking access globally to media funded by the Russian government. The American platform says the decision is in line with its policy of barring content that denies, minimizes, or trivializes violent events. Earlier this month, YouTube also blocked leading Russian channels, RT and Sputnik, across Europe amid Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the American company Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, says it is allowing posts that call for violence against Russian forces. In response, Moscow says it is restricting access to Instagram and has launched criminal proceedings against its parent company. The United Nations has also warned that the anti-Moscow move could spark hate speech against Russians. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett explains how Western media are engaged in a propaganda campaign backed by their governments to deceive the public about what's going on in the world.
Well, everything that you're watching on Russia Today and Sputnik and Press TV as well, these are the sources of truth. These are the source of accuracy. This is the real revelation of what is going on in the ground. You can't believe anything that is coming out of the Western media. So Americans are starved for truth. That's why they have been deceived for 20 years into these endless wars, because of the propaganda that has been forced upon them from their own CIA that manipulates these big tech companies. So we're seeing big tech and the political implosion in America and this emerging deep state just suddenly start coming apart. America has now been caught with evidence of crimes against humanity, bioweapons, violation of international treaties. They've actually went to the United Nations Security Council and are demanding investigations. And that yet again is another issue. The Americans are falling all over themselves, and they're doing it with absolutely no grace. The Biden administration officials are desperate to lie. This is done by people who have lost, who are in the corner, that are wounded and are about to be destroyed by the fire of their own lies.
Thank you.
Russia just needs to be very composed and say to the world, who do you believe, us and the facts and the evidence, or the liars who gave you 9/11 and 20 years of war against the entire world? And I think the world is going to come to the side of Iran and Russia. They just need time to see the truth.
Russia's military offensive in Ukraine is now in its 17th day as Russian forces bear down on the capital Kyiv, while the city of Lutsk, close to the Polish border, is targeted for the first time. Russian forces have repositioned and are regrouping northwest of Kyiv. Airfields in the western cities of Lutsk and Ivano-Frankivsk, have also come under attack. In east-central Ukraine, Russian strikes hit Dnipro for the first time, killing at least one person. Ukraine has accused Russian forces of hitting a psychiatric hospital near the eastern Ukrainian town of Izium. Russia's defense ministry says it would open humanitarian corridors from Kyiv, Sumy, Kharkiv, Mariupol, and Chernihiv. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated in recent days through humanitarian corridors. The UN Human Rights Office says nearly 600 civilians, including 41 children, have been killed in Ukraine so far. Staying with Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky says his country has already reached a strategic turning point in the conflict with Russia and is moving towards victory. Zelensky says he does not know how many days it will take to quote free Ukrainian land, but they will do it. The president has rallied Ukrainians with a series of addresses from Kyiv since the conflict began on February the 24th. He has received support from other European states and the U.S., which have provided Ukraine with money and arms. They have also imposed tough sanctions on Russia, but turned down Zelensky's main demand, that is, a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Western countries say they do not want to directly engage in war with Russia. The EU has also dismissed Kyiv's fast accession to the bloc. Our correspondent Robert Carter is currently in the Polish city of Lublin to update us on the situation of Ukrainian refugees that have been fleeing to Poland. He says ordinary people in Poland are helping the refugees amid the absence of any organized campaigns by the United Nations and the European Union.
Obviously, the situation here is very dire for many refugees, many of whom don't have family here, don't have friends, they have nowhere specific to stay. And the conditions here, I have to say, are cold, icy, there's snow on the ground, temperatures can drop to -7 during the night here. So for women carrying maybe more than one child at the same time, and we've seen children here ages of one or younger that are trying to find shelter in Poland. So it's a very upsetting, very difficult situation to witness. And also, of course, the big question is who is being treated differently in terms of how has Europe responded to refugees coming from Ukraine compared to how refugees that have come from other parts of the world as well. And this is something which we've tried to get to the bottom of here in Poland, and hopefully we'll be reporting on that a little bit later. But question marks surrounding how Poland has handled the Ukrainian refugee crisis compared to how they've handled the Syrian or the African refugee crisis in the past has also raised a lot of questions here. We haven't seen anyone from the United Nations active here. All of the volunteer work that you see going on behind us is actually from Polish civilians who have literally taken time out of their busy schedule to help. In fact, when we went to the main train station here in Lublin, there was a room set up specifically to take in Ukrainian refugees and to help them board other trains, to give them food, to give them warmth. That was organized entirely by volunteers from Poland, Polish civilians. It was not organized by Polish authorities. It was not organized by the UN. It wasn't organized by the European Union. This was something done locally by honest, hardworking Polish civilians who just decided that they were going to help their Ukrainian brothers and sisters, people who they feel have a cultural link to them as neighbors.
The two-day European Union summit has ended in France without major sanctions on Russia. But the member states said historic changes in regards with their ties with Moscow may be arriving soon. Rami Mazahari has more from Paris.
The summit of European Union leaders in Versailles, France, to discuss Russia's military operation in Ukraine, concluded with increasingly belligerent rhetoric possibly overshadowing the rejection of concrete sanctions. Led by the eastern members of the bloc, the EU will not impose sanctions on Russian gas and oil. In mid-May, a proposal could be unveiled to phase out Russian fossil fuels by 2027. The Western members of the bloc led the swift rejection of Ukraine's appeal for fast-track membership to the bloc. The EU and NATO claim they have excluded direct military intervention in Ukraine. The EU did double to 1 billion euros the amount of military aid for Ukraine. It's the first such military involvement for the bloc, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012.
There have been three strategic objectives which Russia did not anticipate. First, the resurrection of NATO. Second, the awakening of Europe. And third, the unity of Ukrainians. I think the Russians had a bad strategy.
Some in Europe are saying that Russia's military action is on the same level as 9/11, and that the EU must bolster cooperation on defense and drastically boost military spending.
Europe needs its own army. After the 1980s, Europe became disarmed and completely reliant on the Americans. Ukraine is the door to Europe, and now Europe has no choice but to arm itself. Europe needs to reconceptualize its own image into one where they can defend themselves.
If the EU follows through on some of these promises and sanctions, Europe will likely see a multi-year effect on prices of food, energy, and basic goods. The green transition, which some think is so vital, will likely need to be reversed. The summit ends much as it began. It's not fully clear how far the EU will go to get involved in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. A poll last month showed that two-thirds of France is favorable to organizing a referendum on leaving the European Union.
If massive and controversial changes aren't approved by a democratic vote, it's possible that the EU may be fomenting even more discord. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A majority of Americans disapprove of President Joe Biden's performance, especially over his handling of the rising inflation in the country. That's what a recent poll shows. It was conducted by the Wall Street Journal. The poll found that 57% of respondents disapproved of Biden's performance. On economy alone, 63% gave him negative marks. Half of respondents said inflation is a main concern for them. Only 42% approved of the president's job. That's roughly the same percentage in a November survey. Rising costs have been a persistent issue for Biden in recent months, despite efforts to unclog supply chains. And now the ongoing conflict in Ukraine has exacerbated U.S. inflation. That's due to rising energy and commodity prices in the wake of sanctions on Russia. Moving on, the United Nations Children's Fund says the war on Yemen has killed or maimed 47 minors in the first 2 months of 2022. UNICEF says over 10,000 minors were also killed or maimed in the Saudi-led war since it began 7 years ago. According to the UN Fund, as many as 6 million Yemeni children could see their education disrupted as a result of the war. It has warned against the tremendous long-term consequences of insufficient learning for these children. Saudi Arabia and its allies have destroyed Yemen's infrastructure, including schools and hospitals. The aggression has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and pushed millions into poverty and famine. Earlier, Melbourne-based journalist Samuel Geddes joined us with his take on UN inaction on Yemen's humanitarian catastrophe caused by the years-long Saudi war there.
We've been constantly told how Yemen is on the edge of a famine or on the edge of a particular kind of humanitarian crisis. But of course, it has been at that stage of crisis for 7 years. From the figures that I'm aware of, the death toll is close to 400,000. And of course, the vast majority of those will be civilians, and particularly civilians with particular nutritional needs. So young children, people with underlying conditions, and the elderly. And yes, I mean, nearly a decade of such acute food crisis, as well as you say, disruption to the educational system and every other system. Yes, this will, without being an expert on child health, I would definitely say that this is going to leave very long-term scars on Yemeni society and on its future social and economic development.
Yemeni armed forces say they have carried out a large-scale drone operation targeting Saudi Arabia's oil facilities.
Our armed forces carried out a wide military operation, the first break siege operation, using 9 drones. The targeting of the Aramco refinery in the Saudi enemy's capital Riyadh using Samad 3 drones, the targeting of Aramco facilities in Jizan and Abha and other sensitive locations using 6 Samad 1 drones.
The army spokesman says the operation was a response to Riyadh's fuel embargo on Yemen. Saudi says his country is ready to carry out more operations in retaliation to Saudi Arabia's aggression and its blockade. The Saudi state news agency has cited a government official who confirmed that a refinery in Riyadh was attacked on Thursday. The news agency, however, said the attack caused a small fire that was contained and the refinery's operations and supplies were not affected. Earlier, we were joined by activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti to get his thoughts on the operation in Saudi Arabia. Let's take a listen.
And as you know, that Saudi has enforced a siege on Yemen for the last almost 8 years. They are blocking especially fuel from entering the country. Many hospitals will be closed in the coming days. And just since Biden was sworn in as U.S. president, Saudi has only allowed handful of fuel ship, and this is actually the first time that fuel prices has increased by 400 to 500%. That's why I think that to call this operation, as they say, to break the siege, I believe that we have started now the countdown for a major attack only that will target Saudi oil infrastructure. And I think especially at this point, when we see the war between Russia and Ukraine, I think, and as well the fuel prices increasing in Europe and other Western countries, I think Yemeni should take this chance by attacking Saudi oil infrastructure. And we have seen that this latest attack that targeted with three drones, Riyadh main refinery, and as well other Saudi Aramco infrastructure and facilities in Abha and in Jizan region. I think that Yemenis are well equipped, and the Saudi and United States know that they maybe the other attack and the coming attack will maybe target Saudi major oil field, especially like in Khamis the major oil field in Baqiq and Khurais that was targeted a few years ago. And as well, United Arab Emirates should not think that they are far away from this attack, because the main goal behind this attack is to break the siege.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed Israel's so-called citizenship law, which bars Palestinian residents from living with their spouses from Gaza or occupied West Bank. Hamas spokesman Jihad Taha said the legislation reveals the true face of the occupying regime, which is after separating Palestinian families. Taha said the move aims at clearing Palestinian lands, especially Al-Quds, from their original residents. He noted that Hamas strongly rejects what he called the racist law. Spokesman added it is in violation of international norms, including the 1948 Global Declaration of Human Rights. And India says the missile it launched into Pakistan this week was fired accidentally. The Indian Ministry of Defense said the missile was fired because of a technical malfunction during routine maintenance. It described the incident as deeply regrettable and expressed relief that no one was hurt. The ministry said the government has ordered a high-level court of inquiry to investigate the incident. Pakistan said the missile was unarmed and had crashed in an area about 500 kilometers from the capital, Islamabad. Pakistan's foreign ministry also summoned India's Charge d'Affaires in Islamabad to lodge a protest. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we'll follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good long trip in the winter. I'm Javad Gharayi. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts: Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains, Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Floodwaters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadi Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Beris to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The valley, I mean the Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berri's Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berri's village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berri's. The villagers moved from Old Berri's to New Berri's around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berri's Wharf. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where Old Berri's used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in New Berri's. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Beris is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They are all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. And this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Beris is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Beris cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful the fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the kilkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful. Sayonara. One of the fishermen gave me this lobster and said I could have it, but I'm going to let it go because it's carrying so many eggs. After my visit to Barry's Wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Oman. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Barry's is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs are where Barry's begins. Those are the shores of Barry's, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that have been here for thousands, or should I say millions of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff, and a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Barry's territory.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
This is For a Better Life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to your program For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, we are living at a time when we do not have access to the prophets and their noble successors. Of course, the door of knowledge and revelation is sealed. We no longer have access to the noble prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and nor do we have access to the companions of the holy prophet, peace be upon him. Therefore, the scholars are there to explain and to elaborate on the teachings of the holy prophet and also on the Quranic verses and the Quranic teachings. The question which may come up to our mind is, who is responsible to guide the ummah and who should take the responsibility? Now, in the absence of the holy prophet and in the absence of the immaculate imams, of course, who is responsible for the purification of the human society from corruption and from moral vices, from indecency, from anything that corrupts the society? What have God and his prophet, peace be upon him and his family, said in this respect? Is it the duty of religious scholars to take the matters into their hands? Is it the duty of the fuqaha or the scholars of ethics to undertake this important responsibility? The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, has said, رَحْمَ خُلَفَائِي فَقِيلَ يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ مَنْ خُلَفَاؤُكَ قَالَ الَّذِينَ يَحْيَوْنَ سُنَّتِي وَيُعَلِّمُونَهَا عِبَادَ اللَّهِ. The literal translation of this hadith is this: may Allah have mercy on my successors. And it was asked, who are your successors or caliphs? The Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, said, those who revive my sunnah and teach it to God's servants. Now, there is no explicit reference to the concept of purification in this hadith. It doesn't say that, okay, it is the responsibility of the scholars to purify the society from corruption or from moral vices. But there's no doubt that purification of the human soul and purification of the human society must be based squarely on religious and divine teachings. And it is understood from this hadith that it is actually the duty of scholars to shed light on religious teachings. It is the duty of scholars to elaborate on the Quranic verses, to explain the Quranic verses to people. It is the duty of the scholars to provide light and to shed light on the teachings of the Holy Prophet and also the Quranic verses, because we understand that the Quran and the prophetic teachings are the most important sources of guidance, the most important sources for the derivation of Islamic laws, for the Islamic laws in general. So the Prophet's Sunnah is not only about teaching, but it is a combination of teaching and a combination of codes and moral advice. And these teachings are aimed at purifying the society, at guiding the humanity towards the right path. Verse 164 of chapter 3 clearly states that Allah actually conferred benefit upon the believers when he raised among them a messenger from among themselves, reciting to them his communications and purifying them and teaching them the book and the wisdom, although before that they were surely in manifest error. Okay, so إِذْ بَعَثَ فِيهِمْ رَسُولًا مِنْ أَنْفُسِهِمْ, of course, it clearly suggests that the Prophet was sent forth from within the people, from the community of Arabs themselves. The Prophet was sent forth not from somewhere else. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oasis. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we love, so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The Prophet was not a supernatural being. The Prophet was not someone from outside. The Prophet was sent from the people themselves. Now the Prophet came from Arab, and the people were most misguided, misled, and indulged in corruption and mischiefs. The Prophet came from the people to guide those people. So the Prophet was sent forth to recite for them the verses of Allah, the verses to speak about the signs of Allah, وَيَزَكِيهِمْ. And then the Prophet was sent to purify those people, وَيُعَلِّمُهُ الْكِتَابَ. And then, you know, teach them the book, teach them wisdom. And they were the ones who were in error, clearly in error. They were the ones who were misguided. So we see, brothers and sisters, that teaching and purification are interlinked in a purification of the soul. In order for us to purify ourselves, we need to understand how to purify ourselves, how to make ourselves pure and cleansed from impurity. Now, teachings and purification are interlinked in the sense that because purification must take place in accordance with Islamic teachings and with what Allah has said, purification cannot occur and cannot be achieved without relying on the teachings of the Holy Quran and without relying on the teachings of the Prophet. For example, the Prophet, peace be upon him, said, clearly indicates and suggests that you Muslims should practice your religion in the same way as I do. And when it comes to, for example, prayer, you should pray in the same way as I pray. Do not add to the religion, do not add to the prayer what is not part of the religion. Do not make the religion difficult for yourselves. Purification of the soul will not take place without following the teachings of the Holy Prophet, without adhering to the teachings of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. The reviving of the Prophet's Sunnah is a duty of Muslim scholars. And this verse also, and the verse, the hadith that I also recited, clearly suggests that the reviving of the Prophet's Sunnah and God's ayat is a duty of Muslim scholars. And they should teach and help people purify themselves. In this time around, which is the time of major occultation, in which there is, for example, in which the Imam is in his greater occultation, we don't have access to him. He is alive, he is present, and he will reappear sooner, inshallah. As long as the Imam is in occultation, of course, it is the duty of scholars to help Muslims purify themselves and to help purify the society and to help achieve perfection and to help achieve a happy life and a better life. You know, the teachings of the Prophet and achieving perfection and achieving a better life are two concepts that go together with each other. Practically, in the absence of the Imams and the absence of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, of course, it is the duty of the clerical institution, it is the duty of seminaries, and the duty of the Muslim scholars to undertake their responsibility of purifying people and the society from impurities. There is no borderline between teaching, you know, and purification. So the scholars are the ones whom we should refer to and whom we should consult in matters related to the religion. The scholars are the ones who actually represent the Prophet, who represent the Imams, and who are the ones who are responsible for teaching, for instruction, and for guidance of the Muslim community and the Muslim Ummah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land.
He knows every shade of palm, every closed hand. He knows every sparkling tear on every eyelash. He knows every thought I have and every word I share. He
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.